From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Donald Trump's trade war with China starts in earnest, and Britain's government takes another wrong turn on the road to Brexit. Welcome to Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I'm Joseph Sternberg, coming to you from our luxury podcasting studio on the banks of the River Thames in London. And Mary Kissel is still safely ensconced in her secure, undisclosed location. I'm joined again today by my friend and colleague Hugo Restall, who is at a different secure, undisclosed location. His is in Asia. Hey, Hugo.
Hi, Joe.
And we are going to jump right into the major story in the global economy today. At the stroke of midnight this morning, Monday, the 24th of September in Washington, D.C., new tariffs took effect on $200 billion worth of imports from China. It's a tariff of 10% on thousands of products. And Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to do this, which he says is going to bring jobs back to America. And he says that trade wars are easy to win. And so as everyone around the world tries to make sense of what the economic implications of this are going to be for the U.S., for China, for trade and the rest of the world, Hugo, I figure we should probably start right where Trump does and look at this move in his own terms before we actually look at some of the broader impacts of this new trade war that is starting. And I think the big question to me would seem to be, is the showdown with Beijing actually as easy to win as Trump and his advisors seem to think it is? And what is winning actually going to mean here?
Well, exactly. We don't know what the envisioned end game of this is from Trump's point of view. I think it's worth stepping back for a moment and noting how remarkable this situation is. The assumption of many of us, myself included, was that Trump was simply looking for an easy win. The Chinese would be able to make some concessions, bring down the bilateral trade deficit a bit, buy some more U.S. Soybeans and other products. And that would be, you know, Trump would declare victory and go on to other issues. And how wrong we were. I mean, really, Trump has now escalated this to the point where it's having a serious impact on consumers, also on American companies, which, you know, have been caught in the crossfire, and many other companies around the world, which go in and out of China and the U.S. So it really is incredible in the sense that he is upsetting so many powerful people's interests, but has plowed ahead nonetheless, giving the lie to the idea that somehow, you know, the interest groups, you know, really run the policy on this. A determined president can really upset the apple cart.
Now, I feel like we do need to dig into a little bit of what some of the interests and the characteristics of the economies on both sides of this U.S.-China dispute are in order to try to game out a little bit how this is going to end up progressing if really the Trump administration does stick to these tariffs for any considerable amount of time. And, you know, maybe the place to start is actually on the U.S. side, because I think that, you know, certainly this theme, this protectionist theme, I think, has always had a certain amount of resonance in U.S. politics, even if it never quite managed to elect a majority in Washington. This notion that somehow trade is a game that America loses, that other countries win at America's expense, the expansion of trade and America's trade deficit on its own is responsible for the loss of U.S. manufacturing jobs over the longer term. These trade deficits somehow weaken the economy. Now, one of the things I find fascinating about the Trump tariffs, and of course, what we have this morning is the biggest tranche of them, but we've already been starting to see other tariffs, aluminum, steel products, those tariffs coming online. Is that we're beginning to understand why it is that it was so difficult to dislodge free trade in Washington, because what people are realizing is that actually American companies have come to rely on a lot of these imported components, the inputs to the things that Americans do manufacture, and that actually American exporters and consumers have a lot on the line in terms of preserving free trade here. So, you know, this has been a much riskier strategy for Trump to pursue from that perspective than I think that many of us probably thought he might want to do.
Right. It's the old problem that if you put a tariff on input, your companies that use those inputs become less competitive. So, you know, in the past, the U.S. policy on sugar has kept the price of sugar high because of, you know, lobby in Florida. The candy companies then were uncompetitive as compared to European chocolate manufacturers in Brussels. So then you have the problem of how do you protect your candy manufacturers and so on. But that is now playing out with the China tariff and the steel and aluminum tariffs as well. So, you know, the longer we stay with this policy, the deeper the losses are going to be to those companies.
And, you know, I think we need to really focus on that issue there, because I think this also explains a lot of the unease globally that we are starting to see as a result of this. I mean, I'm sitting here in London following European economies, and you know, there is a lot of concern about this. And it's not necessarily, I think, that countries are particularly concerned about the bilateral trade balance between the U.S. and China. I get the sense that the real worry is the impact that this has on the U.S. economy. And it is a, you know, and from that perspective, it's a big economic and political risk for Donald Trump, because you know, the economy has been performing so well on his watch. I think that we had the tax reform in late 2017, which seems to be starting to unlock a lot of productive investment in the economy. We've had a lot of capital flowing back into the U.S. as a result of that. You know, the Trump deregulation agenda is a really important piece of that economic policy puzzle, you know, that has really been helping to unlock a lot of growth. And I think that there is concern that these, you know, trade wars that Trump is intent on launching, you know, rather than strengthening the U.S. economy, are actually weakening it at a time when a lot of trade partners are really relying on growth in the U.S. to pull up, you know, a lot of other boats with that tide.
And China, of course, too. I mean, China has been a major engine of global growth since the global financial crisis. In particular, it sort of pulled a lot of Asia through that crisis with its stimulus package. So how does Europe and other parts of the world that are not firing on all cylinders deal with this? And does this let the genie of protectionism out of the bottle in those places as well? Does it start to spread to those economies?
Well, see, that again is the thing where it feels like we're trying to shoot at a moving target right now as we come to terms with a lot of these questions, because you know, there seems to be evidence that there's a bit of a change. I think that a big part of the concern early on in the Trump administration was that actually a lot of these trade policies were not going to discriminate between America's friends versus opponents or competitors. I think that probably actually a lot of European governments, certainly a lot of European companies, would have been happy to cooperate with the Trump administration on some sort of united front to deal with a lot of the very real problems in the Chinese economy that do distort global trade. I think that, you know, a big issue that often comes up is intellectual property protection, Chinese regulators forcing the transfer of intellectual property from foreign partners to Chinese companies as a condition of doing business there. I mean, European companies get hit by that too. Early on, there had been a fear that, Trump was just going to go after everyone. He was pursuing trade complaints against Europe as well, and that was going to hinder cooperation on some of these shared interests on China. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to see some evidence that maybe actually there is a bit more of a cooperative approach developing between the U.S., Europe, North American partners, Japan, on some of these issues than maybe there had been before.
Right. I mean, I was looking at a very interesting piece in the Financial Times, our competitor, on September 11th, called Trade Wars, China Fears an Emerging United Front, talking precisely about this, about how Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, has been having some success, you know, coordinating with the EU and Japanese counterparts on China policy, in particular the issue of industrial policy and the Made in China 2025 program, which forces companies to turn over their intellectual property. So that really is the worry from China's point of view, that the Trump administration will put aside its tariff initiatives against allies and concentrate on China. If that were to happen, there might actually be some chance of a positive outcome in terms of forcing China to comply with it, World Trade Organization promise.
But, and that is something that really we need to focus more on here, because I think that certainly the temptation when, you know, whenever any Donald Trump is involved in something like this, he has this tendency of sucking all of the oxygen out of the room, making it very difficult to focus on anything other than his activities for good or ill. But, I mean, it is important to understand that there are legitimate problems with Chinese economic policy that are creating serious distortions in global trade right now. And those are often not, what people have tended to think. I think that, you know, often, and perhaps even among many people who voted for Trump, the classical view was that China is just becoming the low-wage factory to the world. It's drawing a lot of that lower productivity manufacturing away from countries like the U.S. or European countries that used to do that. I mean, historically, there was an element of that, but that isn't really where the concern is right now. It has a lot more to do with the things that you were talking about, the intellectual property protection, trade conflicts and policy problems that are arising as China moves further up the value chain and starts trying to muscle its way into some of these very high-tech, high-innovation industries and is trying to take shortcuts in that, by relying on state-subsidized credit, various technology transfer requirements for foreign partners. I mean, the point of that is I think that there are legitimate concerns that need to be addressed with China's trading policy. The real question that you have to be asking is, are these tariffs the right way to pursue that?
Right. China is not as dependent on that low-wage manufacturing as it used to be. A lot of that activity is already moving to other countries. But at the same time, there's a retreat of the private sector within China. The state interference in the economy is actually increasing under Xi Jinping. So it's a myth that the U.S. has leverage over China by putting tariffs on all of these cheap manufactured goods. The real leverage I think that the U.S. has is over its control over high technology. China is really afraid that its access to technology is going to be curtailed, and that's really where we get their attention.
And that is the big thing that worries me about the Trump administration and its approach to these issues, because it's not always clear to me that there are people in the Trump administration who understand that. I mean, certainly Trump himself is of a certain generation. He really came of age in the 80s and 90s when there were a lot of concerns about Japanese trade policy. People who were advising him, Wilbur Ross, Peter Navarro, Robert Lighthizer, historically very interested in these old style manufacturing industries. And so I do think that we are going to have to see if that crew of people are equipped to deal with these much more complicated modern trade disputes. But we're reporting from the trenches of Donald Trump's trade war, and this is Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. Robert Half is here to help. Our recruiting professionals utilize our proprietary AI to connect businesses with highly skilled talent. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. WSJ Podcasts. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. I'm Joseph Sternberg in for Mary Kissel, and I'm joined on the line by my friend and colleague Hugo Restall in Asia. And we are now headed up to my neck of the woods, Europe, to talk about Brexit again, whether we want to or not. And certainly we have been trying not to talk too much about Brexit on this podcast because there's so many other instances of global mayhem and disorder going on. But I think that events in Brexit took a pretty important turn last week that we do need to talk about, because there was an EU leaders summit in the Austrian city of Salzburg that did not go well at all for British Prime Minister Theresa May and her attempt to hasten along negotiations to an exit from the European Union. And in fact, it was actually an unusually nasty summit. You had French President Emmanuel Macron, apparently in a fit of frustration with the British negotiating position, calling some of the British politicians who had supported Brexit liars. Prime Minister Theresa May comes back from this engulfed in chaos over the weekend. Hugo, I think maybe let me try to give you my diagnosis of, of this problem in a nutshell, and then you tell me if it sounds convincing.
Okay.
I just think that the real problem that is going on here is that Britain has not been able to articulate a negotiating position on Brexit that makes sense to the rest of the world. I think that, all along the EU has articulated a set of red lines that I think were very predictable from their perspective, having to do with not wanting to cherry pick, because from the perspective of most of the remaining EU member states, they think that the European Union is a delicately balanced web of costs and benefits, and they don't want people to get in the habit of trying to pick off all of the benefits that a member state can achieve without having to also pay some of the policy costs. So, for example, they don't want Poland to think that it can benefit from the ability of Polish workers to move to other parts of the EU, and also Poland's ability to absorb EU budget funds for road and bridge projects, without Poland also having to implement market opening reforms that come with EU membership, and just a whole range of things like that. And what seems to be emerging here is this big failure of British negotiators to comprehend that they're going to have to work within that framework.
Right. So the British wanted, as we discussed last week, to stay in the common market for goods, but not services and all the other accoutrements of EU membership. But essentially, they're going to have to come out of the common market for good to some extent and negotiate some sort of a trade deal. But that trade deal, of course, cannot be negotiated quickly enough for the Brexit deadline, right? So, I mean, how is this going to work?
Well, that would seem to be the $64,000 question here, because it is true that in theory, Britain can leave the EU and then negotiate some kind of trade agreement as a third country, that might include trade in goods. Because the reality is that cutting tariffs on traded goods is not the difficult part of modern day trade negotiations. Services are the sticking point. So there is a certain logic to trying to split off the two issues there. The problem is that Britain wants to be able to continue trading with the EU in the same way that it does right now from a practical standpoint. So without having to deal with border enforcement, without having to have invasive or time-consuming customs checks at the border. And, partly they want to do that for the convenience of companies that are based on the UK mainland and England, Scotland, and Wales, that are plugged into these just-in-time supply chains with the rest of the EU right now. Partly they want to do that to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland, between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But the problem is that you can't really do that if you haven't harmonized all of the rules and regulations. And that really is the sticking point, this discovery that in order to have that kind of frictionless trade that the pro-Brexit politicians in Britain do want, they also have to accept a lot of the European Union rules on product safety standards and other matters like that that they don't want. And I think that is really the sticking point, because if they wanted to leave, they could. It's just that they don't want to inflict on businesses the kind of practical inconvenience that comes from doing that. But they also don't want to adopt the mechanism that the EU has developed in terms of these shared regulations that make it possible to avoid all of those problems.
So what did Theresa May think was going to happen when she came up with this plan at Chequers? It now seems that she was horribly naive in ignoring EU red lines when she proposed this plan, went through all the rigmarole within her own party. and then took it to Salzburg and was humiliated.
Well, see, I think part of the problem here has been figuring out who is negotiating with whom in this process. I mean, you mentioned the Chequers Agreement, which is really this blueprint that May's government developed over the summer. It's named after the British Prime Minister's summer country house estate, Chequers. And what she did basically is summoned all of the members of her cabinet up there and locked them in a room until they agreed on this plan for exiting the, you know, for what Brexit would look like. I mean, the problem is that was really a negotiation where you know, May's Conservative Party has been negotiating with itself on this, because there are a lot of divisions within British politics on this. And, it, you know, that ought to have been a starting point for negotiations with the rest of the EU. And yet you have a large faction within and a very noisy faction within May's Conservative Party who are suggesting that that Chequers Agreement is really an ending point. And I think that that has never been particularly realistic. And part of me feels like when we have spectacles like this fiasco in Salzburg, you know, how much of that is just that you have to have moments like that to prove to some of these pro-Brexit conservatives here in Britain that their plan just isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. But as we were discussing last week, the Labour Party was on the verge of having a conference, which is, I believe is now opened. So what's happening there?
Well, see, I think that the big question in domestic politics now is going to be whether Labour is able to capitalize on this. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, the radical leftist who's the leader of the Labour Party, has a lot of political problems. He's been spent most of the summer embroiled in a scandal involving charges that he and many of his supporters are anti-Semitic in various ways. That is really problematic. And, you know, there's also this division within Labour about, supporter opposition for Brexit. They seem to be working their way around to a position where they might be prepared to offer voters the prospect of a second referendum on whether to actually go ahead with Brexit once a deal is done. I think that that is potentially very dangerous for the Conservatives. I think that, the backdrop to all of this has been a conservative sense that they can kind of natter around with Brexit as much as they want to, because Labour is not a viable opposition. So voters are going to feel like they will be stuck with some conservative prime minister no matter what. I think that that's a very dangerous assumption these days. And one of the things that worries me is the time that you have a very radical leader of the main opposition party, who would present a lot of problems for Britain if he were to become the prime minister. You have a Conservative Party that doesn't really seem to be very concerned about the prospect that they might lose an election at some point.
Right. And Jeremy Corbyn really wants a general election. The question for him has been, would endorsing a second referendum on Brexit resonate with the public and help him in that cause? And the tide does seem to be shifting in that direction now, which is very worrying.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think that British conservatives tend to forget is that there's a real asymmetry in the way that people think about this. So you occasionally hear, especially in parts of the media here that are favorable to conservatives, this notion that somehow Labour is crippled by its divisions on Brexit and is just as bad on this issue as the Conservatives are in their way. I just don't think that is a viable election position, because people tend to expect more of the party to whom they have handed power. And so, again, I think that there are a bunch of problematic domestic political considerations that are underlying some of these calculations that lead into the way that the Conservatives formulate a position on Brexit ahead of a summit like Salzburg, that play to the way that the Conservatives spin that failure once they get back here in Britain, that I just don't think are particularly plausible.
The Labour, I've seen Labour Party people saying that we could handle the negotiations better. I mean, that may not be true, but given how badly things are going, I mean, that's that's at least a plausible election platform.
Yeah, and what a depth you have reached when the most compelling platform people are coming up with is we will not fail quite as badly as the other people. But we have been talking Brexit chaos, and unfortunately that's all the time we've got for today. On behalf of Hugo and myself, thanks for listening, and please follow us on Twitter at Hugo Restall or at Joseph Sternberg, both one word. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio content to make sure that you stay up to date with our running catalog of global disorder. For now, I'm Joseph Sternberg, and this has been Foreign Edition from the Wall Street Journal editorial page. We look forward to coming back to you later this week.